This show is furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Good evening, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervie, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And ever since Carrie Kasem left me, I've had a slew of guest co-hosts with me. And they've been incredible. And this is one of my favorites. Ben, actually, you are one of my favorites. You're the only male, actually, co-host. So that's kind of nice. We're bonding here. It's a guy's thing. Of course, Ben Mycelis talked about how we used to bill him as partner at Garagos, represented Colin Kaepernick, general counsel for Big Three Basketball, 2019 Variety Impact Lawyer of the Year. And now, what do we call you? A serious personality?
I saw that. Serious XM personality or co-founder of Midas Touch. My title's taken a few iterations over the past 6 months, as you just said, but doing incredibly exciting work, and it's great to co-host this with you, Alan.
It's great to have you. Tell us just a little bit quickly before we get to our featured guest. He's got a few years on you, but the Midas Touch, I think, is something that's interesting to a lot of people, and especially our guest today. Tell us a little bit about what you've been doing on Sirius XM, as well as the Super PAC.
Yeah, so Midas Touch is created by me and my two younger brothers, Brett and Jordy. We were sitting home in quarantine. We couldn't stand seeing Trump lying to the American people. So we said we had to do something, and we created a political action committee on May 15th called Midas Touch. It's since grown to become the largest Democratic political action committee in the country. More digital views, than any other political action committee. Our videos do over 1.5 million to 10 million views, each of them, and we've done about 200 of those. We've raised close to $4 million and deployed that money into the field, one to defeat Trump. Right now we're in Georgia doing everything from canvassing to TV ads to radio to you name it, we're doing it there. And through that process, we got a show on Sirius XM Progress called the Midas Touch Show. It's a privilege and so much fun. I get to host it with my two younger brothers. It drops as a podcast on Friday. It airs on Sirius XM Progress Saturdays at 11 Pacific time, 2 Eastern. And it's just been a blast and something totally unexpected during quarantine. But it shows that if you kind of set your mind to something, if three brothers with no political experience can become one of the largest political action committees in the country, you can do it too.
Wow. That was well done. And one of your brothers is in New York, of course, and the other one's here, so you can do it from all over the country. And you're from New York originally, and your dad, Kenny Mycelis, a well-known music lawyer.
We grew up in Long Island, went to law school in Georgetown Law, came out to L.A., practiced as a civil rights lawyer, and really got to bring that advocacy. There was a time where I was in Bakersfield and Fresno, litigating these police misconduct cases there. I think in one incredible case, we exposed this misconduct that one of the cops was actually the main drug dealer in Kern County. His name was Demasio Diaz. He ended up being prosecuted by the feds. And it was just an incredible case, incredible story. But we kind of took that advocacy thereafter. I had the privilege of representing Colin Kaepernick in his collusion case against the NFL, and now we're doing Midas Touch. So it's been an interesting journey, but it's a journey that's brought me here with you, Alan.
So I think that's the important part, right?
Exactly.
I think you'll take a special interest in the Cuban Five. We're going to talk about North of Havana, the untold story of dirty politics, secret diplomacy, and the trial of the Cuban Five. I have a lot of interest in this. I spent a lot of time in Cuba. In my younger years, I went, and I actually interviewed a number of medical students who were thrown out of medical school because of their anti-Castro views. So it was very interesting when I interviewed them. And then I got apprehended in Cuba and I got taken away. And long story, we'll do it on another day.
Explains a lot about you, though. Yeah.
I'm glad that I made it back. I had these videotapes that I gave to a woman who I had met in Cuba, and she actually took them back to Toronto. Those were the days where Americans couldn't travel to Cuba. I was Canadian, so I went from Toronto. I got the tapes back, so I've had them. Very interesting stuff, but for another day, I want to wish everyone a happy Hanukkah for those of you who celebrate. We've had a great time, my family and I, lighting candles this week, and all the best for celebration, the Festival of Lights. Now let's talk about a First Amendment attorney like no other. Now, I don't want to put you down, Ben, because you mentioned, you know, you did First Amendment work, but you got a long way to go to get to where our guest has been. He's one of the country's foremost trial lawyers, a legal historian, First Amendment attorney. Time magazine calls him legendary, one of the best trial lawyers in the country. The Guardian, one of the world's finest trial lawyers. He's founder of one of the country's most prestigious law firms. Business Week calls him ferocious as a litigator. One of America's ferocious. No one's ever called me ferocious. They've called me, called me other names, but not ferocious.
Other F names?
Other F names, yeah, that's for sure. He's represented people like Lenny Bruce in a First Amendment defense case, obscenity charges, Don Imus, Cesar Chavez, Leonard Peltier in a clemency petition to President Obama, the imprisoned Pine Ridge Indian Reserve murders. He represented Nelson Mandela, Andrei Sakharov, Samuel Beckett, Al Pacino, Robert Redford, Daniel Ellsberg, Allen Ginsberg. The list just goes on and on. He's defended Chinese dissidents, Russian dissidents, Indian dissidents, South African dissidents. He's really worked the world, really, not just this country. He's subject of an HBO documentary, Shouting Fire, Stories from the Edge of Free Speech, which is directed by his daughter, Liz Garbus. And I have to put in a word, fellow Brown University graduate, Liz Garbus. We had her partner from Moxie Firecracker Films on, Rory Kennedy, on our show a couple of months ago. So it's very nice. It's like old home week here. Martin Garbus, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thank you very, very much.
That's quite an introduction, isn't it? You thought you were ready to, the show was going to be over. We weren't going to let you talk. Marty, I got to ask you, you know, we talk about all of these advocacies for the individual rights, victim rights. When did this passion to represent the interests of these people, victims, when did that develop in your life and how?
Probably fairly early. I was court-martialed in the Army when I was about 22, 23. I had not yet then gone to law school. And I saw the court-martial procedure. I saw what was being done to me. As a result of that, I ultimately wound up going to law school. And when I was going to law school, I was going to law school at night. And during the day, I was in a courtroom working for one of the great trial lawyers in America, Emil Zola Berman, who had defended Sirhan, and a lot of other cases. So I was very lucky in that by the time I got a law degree, I had already spent 2 years in courtrooms, and I pretty much had a very good sense of courtrooms. And then I just tried, you know, 100 to an enormous number of cases in a very short period of time. It was a law office where you never went to your office, you just were in court, and you'd be in court from September to June. You went directly there, you picked up a case, and you tried it. And ultimately, I became the head of something called the Committee to Abolish Capital Punishment. So about a year or two after law school, I was running around the country doing capital punishment cases. And at some point in time, I became the associate director of the ACLU, started something at Columbia University called the Center on Social Welfare Policy and Law, ran for political office and lost, and at this point in time, I've been practicing 55 years.
That's all, 55 right. years. Right. But, you know, you also drove taxi for a couple of years, and you worked at a Ford assembly line in Tarrytown, yes. New York. Didn't that have an impact on some of these very difficult stories that people don't really get an idea of where the other side is coming from? It's one thing to be in the court trying cases. It's another to be with the people on the streets driving a taxi.
I think so. I drove a taxi for 3 years while I was in law school and thereafter, and I worked in the Ford body plant, the Fisher body plant up at Tarrytown for a year and a half right after college. I did not think I was going to college. My father had a candy store, and my future, as he and I saw it, was to be in a candy store. Although I went to a school, Bronx High School of Science, which had I was the only one from that school who didn't go to college at the end of high school. So yes, I spent, before I began to practice law, I spent a good deal of time between the Army, as I say, under court martial, and working on the Fisher body plant over Tarrytown, and the driving a cab for 5 years. So yes, I had a different experience before I came to law school, and many others have.
And Martin, what would you say is the biggest change or changes that you've seen from when you started practice to the way, you know, law is being practiced now? And any generalities that that you say, wow, this is just so different today than when we started?
When I had a case in the United States Supreme Court called Goldberg against Kelly, which was a Justice Brennan decision. And he said that case was the most important due process case of the 20th century, and he said it would change America forever. He left the court a few years later. Warren Berger comes in. So I came into the law at a time when one could see the great role that law could play. After that, the last 50 years, have been more or less downhill. In other words, the case that he thought was going to remarkably change everything, which I thought was going to remarkably change everything, in fact did not. I'm doing a book now on that case and the hopes that we had for it. But also, when I was starting to practice law, before I was practicing law, Lenny Bruce once said something. He said, you look at the people in the courthouse, you can tell who everybody is. The black guys are the defendants, the white guys are the judges, and the white guys are the lawyers. And that was very, very clear when I started to practice. You saw the discrimination. You saw the prosecutions. You saw it as a conveyor belt. As I said, for the first 3 years of my practice, I ran around the country a good deal, represented about a dozen capital punishment cases. And, of course, the dozen capital punishment defendants were black, poor. So one could, you know, right now there seems to be an emergence and a consideration of these issues by a larger community, but it's all been there. It's only gotten worse because the courts have gotten worse because the Democrats in the 80s, when the Republicans were investing a fortune in taking over the courts, starting the Federalist Society, the Democrats are doing very, very little. So I tried, I spoke about it, I wrote about it, but my voice, like many others, was not paid attention to by the Democratic Party. And that's why you now see these Federalist courts. So that's something different than when I started. And what's different is that I don't think anybody can walk into law any longer with the illusions that I had. And I suppose that the most recent appointees make that very, very clear. And the next 25 years are going to be horrendous. I wrote a book called Courting Disaster, which was a projection of what was going to happen under these new judges.
And you know, you talk about Courting Disaster, the Supreme Court. Back then, Ronald Dworkin, for NYU philosopher, I used to study him. He talked about politics creeping into the Supreme Court before what we're seeing now. I mean, now a few months ago, we had Professor Leiter on from University of Chicago who talks about this as well. But he's more more recent. Back then, you knew Ronald Dworkin, and he talked about this. Couldn't you foresee it versus perhaps what Justice Goldberg was talking about in the due process case?
Yeah, what happened with Dworkin, it was amazing. We were talking at the time of Bush against Gore, and he said, they can't do this, they can't do this. This is not what the law is about. It's unimaginable. And he talked about the law before one acknowledged the extreme way in which politics dominated it. Now, that was his view. For me, politics always dominated it. Whether you had the Dred Scott case, whether you had the cases coming out of Reconstruction, Plessy against Ferguson, that was all politics dominated. But he saw the law as something different than I did. But I remember we were talking. We were together for about that period of time that Bush against Gore was being decided. And what he saw was so much of his life and his ideology being rejected then. He, of course, would be horrified if he saw it now.
Right. Yeah, he would. We have to take a quick break. We're going to talk a little bit about North of Havana when we talk more about how politics creeps into, and maybe not creeps, maybe that's the wrong word. It's
inextricably intertwined.
Inextricably. it's enveloping the legal system. And that's, I think, what Martin Garbus is talking about now. We're going to talk more about that after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. This is Gervie's Law. We don't have the little bumper there, but it'll come up. Art will work on it. We'll get that bumper. We're talking to Martin Garbus, First Amendment attorney. And if you want to know more about Marty's life, check out the HBO documentary Shouting Fire, Stories from the Edge of Free Speech. Marty, you must be really proud of that. Not only does it talk about, and there's so many people in the documentary, but it's done by your daughter. How proud can you be of her? And, of course, your granddaughter, who you spoke to last year at the Harvard Law School speaking engagement you had.
Yes. Well, my daughter, when she was in Cobb, Shouting Fire was done about 20 years after her first film. Her first film was she was a senior at college, and she went down to Angola State Prison, which is one of the worst prisons in the United States. They're called farms. In Reconstruction, after the laws were passed saying that slavery was more or less allegedly abolished, the southern states passed laws so that if a black man spat on the sidewalk, he could get 80 years or something like that, and they would put him into these farms. Mississippi had one, Louisiana had one, and at these farms, all staffed, of course, by blacks, the blacks would be rented out. They would be sent out to the plantations. So before, the plantations had a man, a wife, and a child, perhaps. Now they only had the man. So it was far more profitable for them. And since these men were criminals, they could just work them to death and then get another one. So she did a film called The Farm. It was her first film. She was 24. She got an Academy nomination for it. And her films have been extraordinary. So she's had a history, not just the film she made with me, but she's had a history, and she just had a film come out now called All In about voter repression with Stacey Abrams. And it's been showing all over the country, and it's been very, very successful. And then she made a wonderful film about a singer which some people know, others don't, Nina Simone. That's more my generation, maybe, than some of the people here, but an extraordinary singer with, and the name of the film is What Happened, Miss Simone, A Sad, Tragic Life. So, yes, I'm extraordinarily proud of her. She's been making films that have a social awareness, and she was doing it years ago, before there was a boom in documentary films. She and Rory Kennedy labored mightily, and she and Rory Kennedy, really Rory Kennedy, did a film called On Abu Ghraib and about the tortures there. So she and Rory, who were partners a while back, have done some fantastic films.
Yeah, the Stacey Abrams film was great.
Yes.
You know, I've been just like you, you know, very depressed about the federal court system recently, especially with all these literally unqualified judges that are being appointed. But, you know, at the same time, you know, my feelings are a bit kind of mixed because it did seem that as our political machinery went beyond wacko and in many ways the Republican Party, you know, tilting full authoritarianism, still the federal courts and particularly Trump appointees, you know, case after case that Trump appointed, I mean, the federal courts were a bulwark against some of these ridiculous cases. And Martin, I was nervous going into it just based on how politicized the courts were. Are you surprised that the courts did stand up to these frivolous lawsuits and the Supreme Court recently again rejecting, you know, the docketing of a case that was absurd, not accepting original jurisdiction, and the other
court case?
The case
was kind of a no-brainer, and I think the politics made it such that there was nothing else they could do. I was surprised at a lot of the other courts which came down against Trump, except if you notice that in a lot of those cases, you in the circuit courts, we had a lot of Trump appointees. There were a lot of dissents, 2-1, and by and large, it was the Trump appointees who were voting against the things that we now think are good results. So I think what you saw is the if you had another 4 years of Trump, then the majority of the judges would ultimately wind up, I think, being Federalists. And I think that I don't know what happens in Georgia, but I think that unless the Democrats get Georgia, that they're going to lose Supreme Court appointees, you know, for the next 4 years. I think it's been the Republicans have been very, very successful in mobilizing fights of judgeships and legislatures. The Democrats are about 20, 30 years very late in this, and that's awful.
Martin, I get to ask you this selfishly, too, as the founder of a political action committee in Georgia, and I get to speak to someone as brilliant as you now. What would your message be in Georgia, you know, to the voters of Georgia, you know, at this time?
Well, of course, get out and vote. I think this. I think that whether you have another Trump, it seems to me a Trump personality is now going to be part of American politics. That I think that as the years go on, there'll be various shapes and forms of Trump running a substantial portion of the Republican Party. I think the way Trump has been successful, it'll be unwound, but in the last month, with respect to executive actions, with respect to the environment, he's been extraordinarily successful. And I think that the desires, not of the 70 million people, but of the conservative Republicans to have another Trump-type person, maybe one more graceful, maybe one who doesn't is not as bad with respect to women, or one who doesn't as patently lie. But I think that Trump has set a pattern for the future, that the Republicans have been in large part, and I think the whole question now is the extent to which the Senate control by the Republicans will end things like mail-in voting and will lead to extraordinary voter suppression. I was in Bakersfield, by the way, a long time ago.
And, it probably didn't change much since.
No, Chavez was there, you know, and I was listening to what you were saying. And I was also in Mississippi a long time ago when you couldn't be black and vote. Now, I see that as a large part of the future. I think that the circuit courts are going to be extraordinarily successful in upholding voter suppression laws, like the end of mail-in voting and other things. You know, I think under the Trump, you know, these last months of Trump, there was nothing the courts could do. But I think as time unwinds and Ms. Barrett is there and Kavanaugh is there, and we've already had a case called Shelby against Holder, which undercut many of the protections that we had against voter suppression. So I think that's going to be the battle in our life of the next few years, voter suppression laws.
It's interesting because we got to take a break now, but when we come back, we're going to talk about North of Havana, and you talk about the untold story of dirty politics and secret diplomacy.
Yeah.
You know, it's ironic what you're talking. I'm listening to what you're saying, and it's the same. We're going to talk about what the Cuban Five, but you could apply what went on in that story, what you'll explain to us after the break, to almost any political situation that we're facing now, and that's where the irony exists. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we're back. Talk to Martin Garbus. I'm here with Ben Mycelis, helping me co-host this week.
Doing what I can.
Doing what you can. Doing great. Martin Garbus is not only a First Amendment champion, but a natural storyteller. This is a remarkable Kafkaesque tale of veteran lawyer's efforts to win freedom for his Cuban spy client, who is serving two life sentences for a murder that he did not commit. Suspenseful and moving and infuriating. It's from New York Times bestselling author Joseph Finder. A quick and vivid read, brimming with political intrigue and lessons about what can happen when law and public opinion are used for political ends. Dramatic history and memoir, the fearless and essential contribution to understanding relations between Cuba and the U.S. will enlighten readers. Martin, the reviews have been incredible for North of Havana. Did you ever think there would be such interest in this story? And when did you decide to get it on paper and write this book?
Well, the point that you made before we took the break, namely the relationship of politics to law, the Cuban Five case, which ends when Obama leaves office, was an attempt by the Republicans, and it was the fight between the Republicans and the Democrats over who would get the Cuban vote. And it was the Republicans who wanted to prosecute this case. We didn't have to go into the details of it, but just looking back, it was the Republicans who wanted to prosecute this case. It was the Democrats who were less inclined to do so. And the Republicans, by showing this hard position against the Cubans, helped solidify their support amongst the Cuban community. And it was understood that the Cuban community was essential to the 2000 vote. And in fact, the Cubans turned out very well for Bush. And as we know, they turned out very well for Trump. So for 20 years from 2000, when the case was still up in the air, and you had Bush running on the anti-Cuban vote, and then you had Trump running on the anti-Cuban vote. And one can say that the anti-Cuban vote gave Bush the election, and there was a fear and a possibility here that they would further solidify support, not only in Florida, but in other places in the country because of the anti-communism. So the case was political from the very beginning. What happens in the case briefly is that a plane with three Americans, or Cuban Americans, run by a group called Brothers to the Rescue, which is a right-wing Cuban group, flies towards Havana and is shot down by Cuban jets. And my clients, the Cuban Five, were charged with a role in that shootdown. Now, that's preposterous. My guys were lower-level guys. They would have no right. They would not be able to do something like that. That's a decision made at the highest echelons of the Cuban government. The facts and circumstances that lead up to the shoot down show that the right-wing group was trying to force a confrontation, was trying to create an incident so that America then, in the 90s, would invade Cuba or become even more hostile to Cuba. And after the shoot-down, Rubio and others were saying there should be an invasion of Cuba because these three people were wrongfully shot down. Ultimately, the trial was held in Miami. Ultimately, they're convicted and given two life sentences. Ultimately, three of them served very long life sentences. The last two guys, my clients, are swapped back when Obama is leaving office in exchange for a recognition by the United States of certain rights that Cuba had. I've given you 50 years of history in a minute and a half.
That's okay. But you didn't talk about the money aspect of it, because that's very interesting, and I think you can extrapolate and talk about that in today's political world, how money played a role and the press.
Money played an extraordinary role. What happened was that the jurors pool was going to be drawn from Miami, and the American government, the Republican government, the Voice of America, Radio Marti, spent an extraordinary amount of money pouring through the radios and through the TV. CBS people got paid, NBC people got paid. The paper, the place of the trial was covered most extensively is the Miami Herald, and one Miami Herald reporter got $267,000 for 1 year's worth of reporting.
Wow.
So that he would say X or Y about the case.
How did that work? Did the U.S. government actually just literally just pay him directly? Did he invoice the government?
Yes,
or
they just paid directly. And when the Miami Herald found out about it, after we got into the case and it got exposed, the Miami Herald fired those people. And then the editor of the Miami Herald, a very respected guy, ultimately quit. And they found that they could not control the amount of federal money. Radio Marti, which is part of the Voice of America, is supposed to broadcast not in the United States. It's against the law for them to broadcast in the United States. During this trial and thereafter, they broadcast all over Florida. And the amount of money that Radio Marti got each month was $15 million. So that by the time the jurors got to the case, they had been exposed to all of this stuff tying the defendants to Castro. Also, what the media did, being paid for it, the jurors were sequestered. It was understood that there was a great deal of hostility to the jurors if their names were known, so they were sequestered. But what the media did is they followed the jurors out to the parking lots, saw their license plates, put that up on TV, and, you know, within a very short period of time, everybody knew who the jurors were, and the jurors came under extraordinary pressure. So you had money in the media, you had money exposing the jury, and then you had a six-month case, which was really nonsense. And one of the important judges in that case, ultimately, was a man named William Pryor. Pryor was the judge who recently was the majority vote in Florida saying that felons, before they could be allowed to vote, would have to pay back certain cost fees. As a result of that, hundreds of thousands of felons were ultimately made ineligible to vote, contrary to what the Florida legislature wanted. Now, Pryor had argued a case to the Supreme Court. And in that particular case, it's called the Hitching Post case. What happened in that case in Alabama, in prisons, they would take out black defendants in the early morning, tie their arms to a hitching post so they stood on their toes, and had at their feet a can of water, which they could not touch all day. Dogs could use it, and the cans of water were spilled. And Pryor went before the United States Supreme Court. court. And he argued an originalist theory. He said this practice was permitted at the time that the Constitution was passed. And if you have to, you know, in the originalist theories, you look back at events at that time. So he said the hitching post was lawful and should be permitted. The court slammed them down. But that's the same guy who was in my case. That's the same. He's somebody who Bush tried to appoint, could not successfully get through his Congress at that time. And he tried two or three times to get this guy through, couldn't do it. Ultimately, he made him a recess appointment. So that's a judge who has become now the pivotal judge in that circuit and in the South.
You know, America. Marty, I think we could talk about political bias in judges for hours because there's so many examples, and I know you've talked about that a lot. But I just want to go back to this money interest issue for a minute. How do we get this under control? I could talk about the Citizens United case, which I know you're no fan of, or oil companies in litigation when you said no way to litigate against these companies or tobacco companies. You have all of this money passing through the hands behind people's back, which have such an influence on our future, on our present. How do we get all of these money? I know it's a $1 million question, hard to answer, but what can we do?
I think it's easy to answer. I don't mean to interfere with you. I
think this, that's this okay. Supreme Go ahead.
This Supreme Court is not going to overrule Citizens United. And you're in a war over the issue. And basically, just like the money floodgates have been opened in political campaigns, I don't think you're going to be able to stop it. You're not going to be able to stop it. And there's no reason to believe that it's not going to become worse and worse. I'm involved in a case right now representing a man named Stephen Donziger. Donziger got a $40 billion judgment in Ecuador against Chevron. He tried to enforce that judgment in New York. The federal court invalidated the judgment and ultimately had him disbarred. And we're now in court where they're trying to put him in jail. Exxon has spent hundreds of millions of dollars in this case. This case has been going on 15, 20 years.
Wow.
And they're using him as an example. Donziger's lawyers, mostly like me, are pro bono. And they're using this case as a way of showing anyone who tries to litigate against these big oil companies for climate-related issues is going to get destroyed and broken. So this is a case going on right now. We're going to trial January 16th. And it's the perfect example of extraordinary money. When we go to court, you know, one person will be there on behalf of Steve, and you'll have 10, 15 people from Gibson Dunn and other law firms who represent Chevron who are there.
Wow.
And so money just infiltrates the process, the legal system at every step of the way, like it affects everything else in America.
You know, Marty, we have to take a break, but it's a little depressing listening to this, especially for young lawyers, and a lot of young lawyers listen to this show. When you think about the idealistic thoughts, the conscience of the judicial system, and apparently there isn't a conscience. And I don't know how you, as an attorney representing someone like Steve Donziger, can put forth your best foot and your arguments trying to get the facts out when, unfortunately, there's so much against you, and it's in the form of large corporations and money. We can pick that up after the break. Think about it for a minute. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, Ben, unfortunately, we only have 10 more minutes with Martin Garbus. Who's...
I wish we had another hour.
Yeah, we got to talk to KBC about that. One of the country's foremost trial lawyers. Before the break, Marty, I was talking about what you face in a case like Steve Donziger's when you're going to trial and you have a lot of money up against you. How do you, as the attorney, face the case when you prepare for it, when you're thinking about what may come up and how there may be prejudice and political bias just because you represent someone who is going up against a large oil company like Chevron?
I think you understand it. You do the best you can. You know, you may say it's like your 12-year-old son fighting Mike Tyson or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it is extraordinarily disproportionate. It's not that remarkably different than the civil rights movement in the very beginning when people went down south and you were fighting out of not only Governor Wallace, but you were also, by and large, fighting the federal government until a certain time when that didn't happen. And then again, you don't have an option. I think your audience would very much like to hear Stephen Donziger, and I recommend him for you.
That'd be great.
That's just the best answer. You do the best you can. As Joe Lewis said, you do the best you can with what you have.
You know, it's funny because last night my kids, who are 6 and 7, a little young to watch Rocky, but they watched it for the first time last night. And just seeing in their eyes, they didn't understand everything, but the whole concept that you're talking about was so clear to them. My son had to go upstairs, and he ran up the stairs and jumped at the top of the stairs, putting his arms up. And
right.
It's so important. You know, I can really identify with what you're saying as a lawyer or as a 7-year-old kid watching Rocky for the first time. Ben?
Yeah, Martin, one of the things that I had seen when I went to law school, I think that's really where the problem's beginning. You know, I went to Georgetown Law, and it was a race to work at these big law firms like the Gibson Dunns of the world. You know, and it's interesting, you go to law school for justice, but when you're there, the allure of these massive paydays at the end of law school, especially with mounting student debt, kind of brings you into these firms that are attacking the environment, attacking the people and democracy in many cases, as we've seen with a lot of the Trump challenges. Martin, do you agree with the thesis that there is a lot of problems in law school? And if so, what can we do about it?
Well, I think, you know, you really put your hand on Sophie. It's very important the way we train lawyers and what lawyers should do. As I said, I was blessed in a way by spending, as I was going to law school at night, I was in a courtroom for that entire period, clerking for Berman, just like holding his bag. So I listened to X number of openings, or I saw X number of people being jailed. So I had that experience. Most of the people in law school nowadays have this extraordinary financial burden, which they have to clear away. So I think you have to deal with the question of the economics of law school. You had people's law schools. You know, a lot of good lawyers come out of very bad law schools. When I went to NYU at night, it was an awful, awful law school. It was a long time ago. Over the years, it's become a better law school. But it's the same kind of money inequity exists in the legal system as exists in the political system. Now, somehow, the Bidens of the world are finding the money to run against the Trumps. The legal system has not yet come to any understanding of how a guy like Donziger, facing, you know, 10, 11 guys in a courtroom, can somehow have a lawyer representing him who is an adequate, competent lawyer. And as you and I both know, cases cost money, whether it be investigation, whether it be preparation, whether it be the brief writing and stuff. And if you don't have a nickel, you're dead, right or wrong. So the extent to which money plays a role. By the way, one thing I'd like to say is I ran for DA in 76, and I ran for DA on the grounds of reduced bail and no bail, treating juveniles in such a way, et cetera. I was long before my time. Now you out there have a district attorney who is trying to deal with these issues as no other district attorneys have before. The district attorney in San Francisco, Chesa Boudin,
right,
is wonderful.
He was on our show, by the way, and I really was impressed with what he had to say.
I represented his mother.
Oh, wow.
When she was tried criminally. So when Chesa was a year old, I was trying to get him to get visits with his mother. And the way the police brutalized him as he went through the, you know, whatever the area is, was extraordinary. We had 6 years of litigation until he could sit with his mother in a room.
His life story is really something. A lot of people don't realize it. But I think, you know, when you talk about your past and you talk about someone like Chessa, you look and you see how it forms the person who you are. And when you talk about, you know, defending Chinese dissidents or Russian dissidents, South African dissidents, it's got to come from within. It's like Ben says, you're not going to learn that in law school because you're going to be, they're going to dangle the carrot in front of you, and that's not going to go the same way that your career has gone, for instance.
Right. I mean, and with Chessa, you know, a lesser person would have been wrecked by that.
Yeah.
Chessa was Harvard, Yale, Marshall Scholarship, as I remember.
Yeah.
And then now the DA. So the path from a kid being roughed up, going through the investigation, the cops would put their hands in his rear end and then take those hands and put it in his mouth. And we had to deal with that. They did everything they could to that kid. And he's now the DA.
Yeah.
And, you know, Chessa is extraordinary.
Our DA down in L.A. is a little different.
Yes. Well, and Chessa is going to have an extraordinarily difficult time.
Yeah.
And then I forget offhand the name of the DA in Philadelphia. So you're seeing things now in the DA's offices that you never saw before.
So we only have a couple minutes. Let's see if we can turn this positive a little bit, although it's been, you know, just really enlightening and really interesting hearing you. What can we look at in the future? You're working hard. I'm not going to say how old you are because no one would believe me. But, you know, you've got a case coming up in January. What can we look at first from you, Martin Garbus, and then second as we move forward in this country?
Well, I'm going to continue what I'm doing to the extent that I can. COVID has certainly cut it down. The Danziger trial will be awful to the extent that the resources against Danziger are enormous. And that's just hard in a criminal case. Very, very hard. I think that law school started in a small way. There was a wonderful lawyer in California. He's before your time, called Gary Bellow. He started something called California Legal Rural Assistance Program. He then went to Harvard. And in large part because of him, clinical programs started in law schools where they started to teach young students about courts and trials. I think that's essential. And I think the question of money is essential so that poor people, you know, so that lawyers are not just lawyers of the privileged class. As our kids might be at this time.
Yeah.
You got to get lawyers from a different part of the country.
It makes a lot of sense. Martin Garbus, we really appreciate you spending this last hour with us. It's been really fascinating for Ben and I, and we wish you all the best, not only on the Danziger trial, but as you move forward with your family and your practice. And hopefully we'll talk to you again.
Thank you. It's been a privilege.
All right, thanks. Have a nice evening. Well, Ben, it's another Gervie's Law coming to a close. Thank
Incredible.
You for being here.
Incredible how just much he loves the law still.
Yeah. Midas Touch. Everyone check it out.
MidasTouch.com.
MidasTouch.com. And we'll be back next week with another version of Gervie's Law. I'm not sure what it's going to be about, but it'll be exciting. I promise you that. Take care.
Is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790.
This show is furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.